पार्थाय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धामि भगवद्गीते भगवद्वेषिणी. But that's verse 12 there too.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. Nyeyam yattat pravakshami. Nyeyam yattat pravakshami. Yajnyatva mritam ashnite. Yajnyatva mritam ashnite. Anadimat param brahma. Anadimat param brahma. Nasatthanna saruchate. Nasatthanna saruchate. Nyeyam yat tat pravakshami. Yat nyatva amritam ashnate. Anadimat param brahma. Na sat tat na asat uchate. Na sat tat na asat uchate. So having gone through, you know, this beginning of chapter 13, we go through, I think, all of the values, the Amanit, Tuamadam, Bitumadam, Sachanti, Adarchivam, we went through all of the values. And all of those values are considered jnanam, because they give you the type of antakarana, the type of mind that is necessary to gain this knowledge, right? So that which jnanam here is, it is known by this antakarana is the karana, becomes the instrument for gaining this knowledge. So that's why they went through first all of the values, and now they're going to the nature of that which is to be known. So nyayam, this word, is a potential participle from nya, to know. Nyayam means that which is to be known, right? So yet nyayam, yet means that which. So yet nyayam, that which is to be known. Tet pravakshami, so Krishna talking, tet pravakshami, I will tell you very clearly. The pra stands for praparshena. It means with completely, clearly. I will clearly, completely tell you. So I will tell that. So I will clearly tell that tat, yet, which nyayam, which is to be known, which is Brahman. The tatparya of the whole Gita is the nature of Brahman. So, and the subject matter that we're discussing now is the Atma, which is Brahman. So that is what is to be known. So nyayam is referring to Brahman. Okay, so, nyayam yet tet pravakshami, yet nyatwa. Indeclinable past participle nyatwa. Having known yet which, having known which, amritam ashnute, one gains amritam, freedom from death. Mrita means to die, death. Amritam means freedom from death. So I will tell you that which is to be known, having known which, one gains freedom from death, amritam. Okay? Amritam, ashnute. That which is to be known is what? Anadimat. Anadimat means anadi, that which is free from, has no beginning. Adi means a beginning. Adi, the word adi means beginning, the word anta means end. So here, they're negating the beginning. Anadi, anadimat, that which has no beginning. Param, which is infinite. Desha kala vastu aparicheda, which has aparicheda, no limitation in terms of desha, space. kala, time, vastu, any type of objectivity, any type of quality or objectification. So anadimat, that which is beginningless, which is padam, infinite, brahman, that which is brahman. So I will teach you that, knowing which, I will teach that, I will tell you clearly that which is to be known, having known which, one gains freedom from death. What is that? Brahman, which is infinite, which is inanimate, beginningless. That Brahman, what is that? Sat, tat, na. Sat, tat, na. Asat. Na. Go further than that. See what says Brahma there? Brahman. Then after that it says na. Na, sat, tat. Then it says na, asat. So you'd go like this. Na, sat, tat. And that tat, na, asat. So what it means, that Brahman, which is na, sat, means it is not an object of existence. All of these things here, each thing that we experience, this is, anything that you look at, it is. Any object, any experience, right? Anything that you can experience, that experience is. That is what we mean by sat. Brahman is not sat. It's not a thing which exists. In terms of duality, it's not a thing which exists. But it is also not a sat. It's not a thing that does not exist either. So it is neither sat nor a sat. So sat means that which exists. A sat means that which does not exist. Well, that's very interesting. Okay, so that was so the things to understand here. First of all, Brahman is what we're talking about. Brahman is that which is to be known, right? And knowing which, one gains freedom from death. That Brahman which is to be known. So hear the sat in this. That Brahman which is to be known, right? Having known which, one becomes freedom from death. Free from death, that Brahman, which is infinite, so param, Brahman is infinite, Brahman has no beginning, and Brahman, that which is called Brahman, that uchate, it is said to be neither sat, nor is it asat. So in your experience of the world, we can have these two experiences. Like, for instance, I can say, this cup is sat. This cup is, right? But, you know, the saucer isn't here. It's just a simple example of a sat. There's no saucer. The cup is. Just in our experience right now. This cup is, but there's no saucer. Right? That's just a very simple. When you say that something is sat is not sat, that immediately is going to negate all of the things that are here. If you negate all of the things that are here that exist, anything that you can conceive of that exists, and you negate those, there's two different levels of looking at this, so I'm going to look at just one of them now. Anything that is, that you experience, Brahman is not that. Okay. Anything that is, that can be experienced, that you experience, Brahman is not that. The other thing is, then you would say, then Brahman doesn't exist. Right? If I take all the things that I can objectify, all the things that one can experience as sat, it is, and we say Brahman is not that, then the next thing in your mind is going to be, well, then Brahman is not, right? If Brahman is an existence, then Brahman would be non-existence. If everything that is, Brahman is not, then if everything that is not Brahman, then Brahman is asat. Brahman is not, the unnegates, right? So then Brahman is asat. But here he says, anticipating that, he says, no, Brahman is not asat. Brahman is not anything that exists, but Brahman is also not non-existence. You see that? That's one way of taking this, which is fine. But there's another way too, that you can imagine things that are not. This is not. Brahman doesn't fall into this categorization at all of those things that are, nor in those things which are not. Neither of these categorizations is Brahman. It is not an object of existence, and it's not something that doesn't not exist either, in terms of objectification. The other way is, everything that exists, Brahman is not. But Brahman is not non-existence. You see what I mean? So here, but the thing is, this is already, in a sense, said. I'm going to tell you that which is to be known. I'm going to tell you that which is to be known, having known which one gains immortality, freedom from death. So then you think, okay, I'm going to tell you that which is to be known, having known which one gains freedom from death. And that which is to be known, that is anadima, it's beginningless, and it is infinite. And so, when there's a pala involved, when there's a fruit involved, like freedom from death, they're not going to be talking about something which doesn't exist. It's like, it would be like saying, your liberation, you know, your freedom from suffering, because it's really interesting, because if you really think, freedom from suffering is your non-existence. Your freedom from suffering is when you finally, at the end of it all, your existence is snuffed out. That's your freedom from suffering. That's your freedom from death. It's like saying, I'm sorry, but this is really interesting. I hope I'm not confusing you.
You're being a poor vipaksha.
What?
You're being a poor vipaksha.
Yeah, it's a poor vipaksha. Just think about this. If you think that Brahman is non-existence, right? So let's take Brahman. Brahman, this moksha, liberation, you know, is recognizing Brahman, which is absolute non-existence. So what would that mean, you know, if in the end, that your final realization is that the whole freedom from suffering has to do with the absolute annihilation of your being, of being itself, the attainment of absolute non-existence. Now the attainment, and this is ridiculous, but we have to play with it a little bit. The attainment of absolute non-existence would be what an atheist would believe. Like for instance, when I die, that is the end of everything. That is the end of everything. In that state, when there's the absolute annihilation of being itself, I will be gone, zip, zero. At that time, there will be no suffering. Right? There will be no suffering. And in a sense, it is infinite in its non-existence, because there is nothing else, you know? So the annihilation of me, right, is the liberation. And another thing, I won't be born again. Amritam. I won't be born again. So is that the discovery? Is this the discovery that really moksha is the annihilation of your being? The recognition that there is, in the end, non-existence, and the non-existence itself is freedom from suffering, because non-existence, I'm not talking about shunya here, I'm talking about non-existence. Non-existence is not here. So there is a non-experience, because there is nothing there. And that nothing being there is moksha, is freedom from suffering. And it is infinite in its own right, even though it's the infinity of zero, because there is nothing else. If the bottom line is non-existence, then there is nothing else. It's padam, It's the padam, it's the infinity of nothing, of zero. It's very kind of interesting. So why I'm saying all of this is because here what's being said is that when you start negating, doing a neti neti, not this, not this, not this, you know, you're objectifying everything and negating it. Then you have to say, when you negate everything that you know, everything that is objectifiable, when the identification with your body and your mind and your sense organ and the limited being, this me, that the me, that what makes me, being totally identified with the body, mind, sense organs, you know, as these upadis, is what makes me, when that identification is so total, when we do the objectification, and the not this, not this, not this, then you're throwing everything out, and you can throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. You forget that there's somebody left, that there's something left, because the identification is so much. And so here they say, you know, this Brahman which is to be known, knowing which you are free from death. And also, the meaning here is free from death, and that your being never dies, but also you're free from reincarnation. That's another thing that has to be brought in here. That self which is anadi means that self which is free from change. Said all of these things. Up to this, you can just think, okay, all of these things are because I don't exist. You know? So he says, but that Brahman is true. It is not sat. It is not sat. It is not existence in terms of an existent thing. Same thing in the Kena Upanishad. But it is not asat either. It is neither sat nor asat. But that Brahman is. So there's going to be that, but it's neither sat in terms of the objectified world, nor is it asat. Right? So everything that is objectified now, everything that can be objectified as sat or asat, is dismissed, right? The objectification of sat is exist, is dismissed, but non-being is dismissed also. And so then, we have to see, you know, what is left. And so at this point, he's going to go through really the whole teaching methodology. And this is really, in fact, it's a really big verse. What I was trying to do in the contemplation, you know, is that I feel that the words that we use, and this is just a little aside because I want to bring it in for what we're going to be doing, the words that we use to point to Brahman, you know, or to point to my being, are words that don't necessarily land on me. They don't land on the very personal me that is Brahman. See, when we say personal me, that personal me is totally identified with the body mind. And that's what makes me different from you. And that's the me that I'm attached to. I'm attached to the me, the self, that is this body and mind. That's why these concepts like Brahman or awareness or consciousness, you know, or big self, they don't mean anything. They don't really care about it. Not really. They're nice concepts, but they're only nice concepts. They're only useful to me, meaningful to me, when those words are pointing to the me that I take to be me right now. That's why the Satyam Mitya understanding is so important. That's why Swamiji hardly even uses Drishya Viveka anymore, the seer seen anymore. Because you have to hone in on who you take yourself to be right now in this body. Otherwise, you're giving yourself, the me, over to the body, which you're objectifying, and then you have some concept of what is left. And so if you sit in this body and recognize this body that I am, right? If we sit with that, this body that I am, and we make a shift in our mind between the name and form of the body, which I am, and the me, the self, which this body enjoys, right? It's just like the pot shifting its attention between its own form and its being. It's shifting back and forth between the nama-rupa, the name and form, and the clay, say the pot's meditating, or following this meditation. It's going back and forth from the pot, like the exterior name and form that it's aware of, right? And then focusing on its own content, shifting back and forth like that. So like, say, if you're sitting with this body, and right now, if you just let yourself be aware of the physical form that through the sense of touch you're aware of, and then you do a little shift just to your own presence, the me that has this body. These sentences are useful. I am my body to I have this body. Yeah. I have this body. Somehow the words release the I a little bit, right? I am this body. Do I have this body? The I is released, slightly released. And I allow myself then to just focus, right? If you make this shift, it allows me to focus on the I part of the I am this body, right? Or I have this body. It allows me to focus on just the me. That me is Brahman. It is that me that the words like awareness and consciousness and being, pure being, all of these words are trying to make you focus on this personal me. And then these words such as anadi or beginningless or changeless are pointing, it's like saying, look at you, the one who is indwelling, the one who has this body. Look at how the body is changing, the perceptions of the name and forms are changing. But you're not. You don't have a form. When you shift the focus just to your being, there is no change. There is no beginning. There is no end. These words don't even apply to the me. You can shift from the body to your experience of the mind or the thoughts. It's the same thing. The thoughts are changing. They're shifting. They're coming and going. But the me, the one who has the mind, is not shifting, is not changing, is not even touched in any way. And so that little shifting back and forth between them, the me, the shift is like this. You focus on the me that you take for granted, that you take to be the body, the me that you take to be the mind. That's fine. You just stay there, the me that is the mind. And then you shift back and forth between the names and forms of the mind that are changing and the me, the one who has the mind. And when you focus on the one who has the mind, using that kind of language, you focus on the one who has the mind, there is no thought. There is no emotion. There is no form. There is only me. And that me, if you just relax into that me, then you ask yourself, do I change? Can I change? Can I do anything about me? Can I get rid of me? Can I put a bag over me? Can I hide me in any way? Can I think of another thought and have that me go away? Can I go thinking of the body? Can I think of my knee and then my foot? You know, and then the whole body at once, does any type of thought do anything to me? And you should start thinking like that. Can I have a thought? Or can I have an experience where the me that I take right now to be me is touched or changed in any way? Is there any difference between the me who is here using my sense organs enjoying the waking state and the me in the dream? Right, that's why the whole Mandukya Upanishad is trying to make you focus on the me that you take to be me and realize the whole Mahavakya is that this me that I take to be me now, but is totally identified with Maya, really the things that come and go and are subject to birth and death, it is this very self that is me that is Brahman. That this very personal self that is you, this me, you know, is the me in all beings. That's what the Mahavakya is. You know? But the problem that I think is why this knowledge is difficult to communicate is because none of the words that we use, all the words that we use have to be handled and worked with and played with and have this word come in, but this word has to come in to kind of change this word. That's what we call lakshanas. The whole teaching methodology is like shooting these arrows, you know, and they all have to converge together onto you. And they often miss. They often miss because the identification of me with the body is so complete. It is so complete that it's as though hidden. It's as though hidden. And the other words become pointing to something else to be recognized or discovered. Something a little more subtle. Something a little bit more subtle, a little bit more spiritual, a little bit more Brahman-like. A little bit more something. Not just simple me that you already recognize as me. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm saying the same thing over and over, but that's all right. Now, the thing is, once you get an understanding of that, once you see that, then the thing is that moment to moment, day to day to day, you start to recognize that you are always there and there's nothing you can do about it. That nothing can take it away. Nothing can take your being away. And then you start to develop more, your mind, I'm talking, it starts to develop more and more of a relationship with you. By relationship I mean there's a discernment on the part of the mind between the very stable presence that is me, right, and itself. And you get to know yourself. The mind gets to understand yourself. How solid you are. How stable you are. How benign you are. There's not even words. These are all words. Can't really... They can land on you because you're there for them to land on. Somehow all the whole teaching methodology of Vedanta is using words to direct the mind to the recognition of the stability and changelessness of your own very personal presence, and then to recognize that the personal presence that is you is Ishwara. The very personal presence that is you is Brahman, which is the self of Ishwara, that this very personal me is your very personal me. It's not twins. It's that the conscious being, the me that I am, is not an object competing with other objects in the world. This being can't be objectified. It's self-evident. It's awareness. It's self-luminous. Right? It's not being lit up by anybody. It's simply, you simply are. And nobody can do anything about it or shift it in any way or make it or cover it. Your emotions don't cover it. Your darkness doesn't cover it. You know? Nothing really covers it. In fact, your ananda doesn't even cover it. You can have a blissful experience, say a meditative experience or a moment of joy. There's still, that moment of joy is wonderful. I'm certainly not against those. But what I'm saying is that your being is shining in its own right in that moment of joy. You're present. You are present to the moment of joy. Right? Your being is there pervasive to the moment of joy. Your being is there pervasive to the dull moment, to the moment of agitation. Your being isn't covered by it. No. Because you're there. And, but the problem is that we're looking for an experience of my being. But the experience is a mental experience, rather than just the one who is there as the self of every experience. The you that is there as the self of every experience is its own self-evident, is the own self-evident me that isn't dependent on an experience. You're the one who's there as the self of the experience. So it doesn't matter what the experience is. You're the one who is always there no matter what the experience is. And so that you is the you that you take to be you right now. It's what the ahankara, to understand this, what we mean by ahankara, this I notion, the ahankara is just what we do when we say, you know, I have this body. The I is 100% correctly labeling you. It is rooted in the true you, the me. But what the ahankara does is lasso my being, this me, identifies it with the body, or with the mind, or with my emotion, or with my thought. But the ahankara itself, the I, is landing on me, who is Brahman. So that's why I know with, like, Ramana used to, in his, you know, satsangs, he would say, just notice where the I is coming from. From where is this I rising? What is the self that the I is rising out of? That's perfect. You know, because he's using the word I, the I that you use for yourself, but he's trying to make you see what it's really, where it's really coming from. And then you see what it lands on. It starts with you, and then it, because of the mind which is indwelling the body, that ajnanam is there, and so it confuses your own self-experience with the body-mind-sense organs. That's what's going on. And so now in the Vedanta, and like in the Bhagavad Gita, what Krishna is saying, this is the self which is to be known, right? This self now has to be the self that is you. This is the self that has to be understood as being free from anything that can be objectified, that from its own standpoint is limitless. It's anadi means it's changeless. It's padam, it's limitless in the sense that from its own standpoint there is nothing else. As you'll see when we get to, we have to go to analyze this whole creation, which he's only actually going to do in a few verses. This whole creation, when you analyze it, the nama rupas, the names and forms that you're experiencing, they fall away. They fall away because they're subject to change and infinite division. You can't find anything here. But every analysis of any type of duality, the one thing that it doesn't touch is the being itself. Every analysis, every dissection, you know, everything comes into being and goes out of being. If you break anything up, if I take the lamp apart into its components, those components still are. If I take it down to atoms, those atoms still are. You know, if I take them to quarks, they still are. The one thing that never changes is the being that everything enjoys. But that being is non-objectifiable. You're not looking at being. You only are being. But now we're using the word being. And as soon as you use the word being, it tends to drift away from me. Mm. From the real nature of being, which is my own self-experience. We don't have any experience of being apart from me. Otherwise you would be able to objectify being. There is me and there is being. But the being, this word, really is only my own amness. There's no being apart from the amness that I am, that I enjoy. You have to the amness, my own existence, my own being, is the being that we're talking about. So Swamiji will joke sometimes and say, you should just say like this, okay, I am, you am, you know, the painting am, the rug am, everything am. That's using the language in a way, keeping it to what it actually is. There is no amness, arness, and isness. Right? And so, it's easier for you to understand what we mean by the word being to use the language that you use for being, which is your I am, right? If I say I am and it is, then in my mind I think there's some difference between amness and isness. As though there's a shift in experience, or I say my amness, and then I use an abstract word like being, does the word being land on you? Since I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being. You know, does it land on me? It has to land on me, or it's landing somewhere else, or it's not supposed to. So it's very, very tricky, because our entire language is meant to land on something else. All of our words, you know, land elsewhere. So you have to rein all of that in so that they land properly. You know, one of the tricky, or the tricks in this whole thing, in understanding it, when we say the whole Mahavakya, the whole Vedanta, has to do with non-duality, that there is only one non-dual truth. It's a very abstract, but nevertheless, there's only one non-dual truth. There's only one thing, in other words, there's only one thing that is here. One, undivided, without any type of duality. There's only one, that's like saying there's not many sets in this world. There's not many sets, there's only one set. And in this one set, there are not many members, there's only one member. Mm-hmm. And in this one member, there are not many parts, there are no parts. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we mean by non-dual. It is one without a second. There are no second thing at all. Now, if that is the truth, mm-hmm. then this, whatever it is that is non-dual, one without a second, has to be me, or I don't exist. It has to be me, or I'm not here. Do you understand how that would be? Like, we can say, in this room there are all of these many things, all of these many things, and I'm included in all of these things here. But if the truth is that there is only one non-dual thing here, whatever that thing is, you know, then all of us have to be that. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean? If we say all of that has to be that, it means that one thing that is there is me. But the me is only one. So the me, when you say from the standpoint of the upadhi, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am, all of those I's are referring to one me. Right? And so the one me is like the water of the ocean, right? Not in terms of space, but in terms of what is actually there. So it's a long ways to go here, in a sense, to recognize that the me that I am is the me that you is the me that Tibby is the me that the ant is the me that Hitler is the me that all beings are, is the me that all the devatas are. You know? Is the me that all of the creatures in hell are, if there's a hell, you know? All of the me that all the criminals are. The me that there is only one me, which this whole creation the whole Maya creation enjoys. You can understand it, though, in reference to your dream. There is only one me. And the dream can be a scary dream. In the dream, there can be monsters, and, you know, there can be devatas and asuras and good guys and bad guys and all everything imaginable can be in that dream. But that dream enjoys only me. I am the me, the one self. I am the self of all of those beings. Like that, I am the self of all beings. I am yourself. But if I say I am yourself, because the Dehatma Buddhi, this identification with the body is so much, I say I am yourself, and you can think, how can she say I am yourself? Mm-hmm. You know, because there's that Dehatma Buddhi. But that's what we keep recognizing, you know, is that this me, and one why there's so many logics here, because once you see it, once you start understanding it experientially in terms of where the I actually lands on, where you recognize from the standpoint of your own upadhi, your own body, mind, sense organs, when you recognize that in fact the self, your being, can't, the me, that yourself can't be objectified. It's, you're not looking at it. It's self-evident. You know? And you can't change it. Your mind can try. You can have all different kinds of thoughts. You can try to touch it or try to change it. You can't change it. You can't do anything. As you start recognizing that, that becomes, in terms of a logical syllogism, it becomes the initial statement that has a lot of logical implications. If I can't be objectified, and you can't be objectified, there's nothing to make us different. Like this, I can objectify you, and I can objectify my body, and you can objectify your body, and you can objectify your sense organs, and I can objectify my sense organs, and all my thoughts, and you objectify all of your thoughts. That's a subject object. These things are Maya. They can all come and go. They come and go. Yourself never comes and goes, and it's not objectifiable. Yourself never comes and goes, and it's not objectifiable. What's between us to make for two selves? It's not going to be space. Space is objectifiable. It's not going to be time. Time is objectifiable. What is it that divides my being? You can't say the body, you can't say the mind, you can't say the sense organs. Those are all exist within duality. They all come and go. And so we start to even understand logically that I am you. It's illogical to think that I'm not. It becomes illogical to think that I'm not. First of all, you can't establish any substance in the creation. But in terms of your own being, you know, once you recognize the kind of the mityatva of the body and of the sense organs and the mind and of space itself, what is making us different? That's the thing. So there's so much to this teaching right now, and just in this verse is just introducing teaching. This now the rest of this, in fact, the rest of this, the Gita is on the Mahavakya. Remember, he spent the first six chapters on the Tvampada, the nature of the jiva, and the atma in reference to the body, mind, sense organs. Next six chapters, Ishvara. Now it's all Mahavakya, the identity between the jiva and Ishvara. And so these verses, if you read ahead, it's the whole teaching methodology, one verse after another, the entire teaching methodology. Yeah. And once, I would say it's like this. Once you recognize your being, what we call the pratyegatma, the very personal me that is non-objectifiable, that is there amidst all of the changing experiences, that it remains untouched and changeless, you recognize that. Then, like dominoes, everything else falls away. You know, in terms of the Advaita establishes itself. Once that initial recognition is there, then everything falls into place. But if the initial recognition isn't there, whether you do it through Satya Mitya or Drishtav Iveka, nothing falls into place. Because it's just about something. It's just some intellectual verbiage that can make intellectual sense, but there's no liberation about it because it's not about you. And so the pramana's not working. And it's not happening. You have to recognize in your own interior, because, look, there's another thing to understand here. If I look at this table, I don't get to be the table. I'm looking at the table. I'm not the table. But I am this body. I'm experiencing this body, mind, sense organs, both subject and object are contained in this experience of this, of the jiva. When I look out, I'm only experiencing through my eyes the external nama-rupa of the name and form of the table. I'm not experiencing the table from inside of the table. But I am experiencing everything to be experienced in terms of this body, mind, sense organs, in terms of subject-object. You understand? You understand what I'm saying? And so I'm the one to work with right now. And then once I recognize the truth of the jiva, this body, mind, sense organ, since because of the antakarana and the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, you know, this is like me. This acts as an upadhi for me. The table's not acting as an upadhi for me. So everything that I need is right here. And so once I can discern my being in this, in reference to the body, mind, sense organs, then I can understand it in reference to the sensory experience. There's a jump there, right? Sensory experience, this is all external to the body. As though, I mean, I'm sure the body is known through the same five sense organs. But it's a different jump. But first I have to be able to discern amidst all of the nama-rupa, amidst the maya, my own presence. I have to start here. It's the easiest way to start. And once you do that, once you single out your own being, then you can see that actually everything is in your being, experientially. But first you have to recognize you. So that's what's happening here, just starting on that. Let's stop. Purnamada, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamudachyate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.